So the panel, as you can see, is the subject matter is diagnostics. And I would submit that for the mass majority of oncology care, we've been treating patients empirically. We still do. We will continue to do so in the future. I note that there are some kiddos in the audience, and so I'd like to speak to them in particular and submit that without diagnostics, we're essentially groping in the dark. And with diagnostics, you're able to at least shine a light into the fog and potentially see what it is you're trying to treat and perhaps position your treatment properly. And if I were a high school student and I were here and I was looking at all these different amazing developments going on, I'd ask myself, well, it's great that we can treat patients, but are we actually seeing what we're doing? Are we actually able to select patients a priori that are going to be most responsive to treatment? Are we able to identify patients before they even become cancer patients and perhaps flag those as future cancer patients? And while we're in the treatment algorithm, are we able to make treatment decisions on the fly in real time based on more than just observation of tumor progression? So these are kind of the three overarching questions for me, and we have an excellent panel today, and I have a lot of questions for them that I think we're going to get into and hopefully tackle some of these questions. So just to reiterate what I said, I see this as a triad of topics, and starting with the question of using diagnostics as a means to screen and detect cancer before it happens, or perhaps in high-risk precancerous conditions, I have a couple of takeaways that if you walk away with these and nothing else, then I feel like I've done my job as a moderator, and I invite my panelists to disagree or to divulge further on some of these different topics. But in terms of screening and early detection, screening seems like it would be a no-brainer. Certainly if you speak to the average layperson and ask them, or they ask you, as my mom likes to ask me, why aren't we able to detect cancer until it's too late? And if you have loved ones or if you know people who present with symptoms only to be operated upon and diagnosed with a stage 3 tumor that's been developing for the past decade, which I have, it's very easy to ask that question. And it turns out it's not a no-brainer, right? And we learned from Dr. Esserman's talk this morning, you can identify patients that are the wrong patients, even if you look harder. There's this issue of morbidity versus mortality. You may find lesions, but should they actually be resected or not? So screening, not an easy one. We have Ken Bloom on the panel from Human Longevity, who's looking at just that. Some other companies on the panel as well. Then in terms of patient selection, as I've said, I would submit that the past, the present, maybe the future of therapeutic positioning has been characterized by empirical one-size-fits-all. We heard from Mike and his panel earlier about cell therapy as being a targeted approach and living therapy and advanced therapy and very exciting. But as we know, there are no CD19 negative patients, at least I don't think there are in the malignancies that these drugs are approved for. The same can be said for BCMA and myeloma. What happens when we get into situations where you do have to go after a particular target? You're going to need diagnostics, of course. But certainly one can argue that the low-hanging fruit is currently being picked with cell therapy, and it gets harder from here forward, as has been discussed. Diagnostics themselves as a business model, and we'll get into this, are largely regarded as a cost. I wrote here that they're guilty until proven otherwise, whereas therapeutics are able to charge, or the therapeutic manufacturers are able to charge at a premium. diagnostic companies are making the case for cost savings, improved efficiencies, and diagnostics, certainly in patient positioning, patient selection as a business model in itself, is a challenging one. And then the topic that I know the least about, and but I'd love to learn more about and perhaps get educated by my panel and the audience, is that of adaptive treatment algorithms. So once you have a patient who's presented with cancer, they're well into their treatment algorithm, they're progressing on therapy X, it's time to switch them to therapy Y before it's too late. Do we have diagnostics that can do better and manage, allow practitioners to make treatment decisions in real time better than what's currently happening right now? Again, I would submit this would require a paradigm shift. It would be disruptive, which is usually kind of a sexy thing to say, but in reality, it would be disruptive to the treatment algorithm. And I think when you ask practitioners to disrupt what they're doing currently, it introduces a real wrench into the works. So just to dive a little bit further into each of these different topics and to give kind of a preamble of the questions I'm going to have for my panel, when talking about screening and early detection, what is the business case? So there are investors who collectively have given Grail, for example, $900 million in a single round. That's a lot of money. Obviously, it costs a lot of money to detect cancer before it happens. So I understand the costs. But is there money to be made there? Is there a return on that investment? And if so, how? Is this technically feasible? We've seen examples like in ovarian cancer where routine screening does more harm than good. And Dr. Esserman talked about this in breast cancer as well. And the same can be said for prostate cancer and PSA. And then what are the implications for intervention? So there's a striking example with Revlimid in high-risk smoldering myeloma where you can intervene and prevent progression to actual symptomatic myeloma through the use of Revlimid. But those are generally the exception and not the rule. And finding other interventions that can be used, or perhaps just recommending increased surveillance in cases where we know patients are more likely to develop cancer going forward. In terms of patient selection, and this probably is the meat of our discussion, if you in the audience are a pharmaceutical manufacturer or a development stage biotech company, these are probably the most salient questions for you, or at least they're the most salient questions for me. What are you testing? So in the case of, and now we can get into immuno-oncology, which of course is going to be a recurring theme throughout today and tomorrow. What do you test? Where do you look? Do you look at PD-L1, for example, on tumor cells, on immune cells? Turns out, depending on which cells and which tissue you interrogate, the proportion of patients who turn up positive versus negative are going to be very different. There are concerns about consistency, again, with PD-L1, and so Blueprint is an ongoing initiative to try to determine whether the different PD-L1 tests are, in fact, interchangeable with one another. And this, of course, is a relevant theme when you have five anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 targeting therapies on the market. Each, in some shape or form, could potentially be positioned in a pre-selected patient population. A big question is, again, the business model. So what's becoming somewhat of a dated case, but an interesting one nonetheless, is that of Tesaro and PARP inhibitors. And the magnitude of benefit for ovarian cancer patients who are germline BRCA positive versus negative in the maintenance setting is very different. Nonetheless, you see a statistically significant benefit for GRBCA negative ovarian cancer patients when they go on a PARP inhibitor. And so Tesaro and Myriad, who's the diagnostic provider, went to court, or at least they threatened to go to court. I'm not sure whatever actually happened with that, to decide whether specific press releases were damning to one company versus the other in regards to whether a diagnostic test should be considered a companion diagnostic or not. And how do you satisfy regulators? We had the landmark approval of Keytruda in MSI high patients regardless of tumor type. So that certainly satisfied the bar for regulators. Are there other examples like that where it's a little bit more ambiguous? And then finally, in terms of adaptive therapy, how do we validate diagnostics in this setting, whether it's minimal residual disease in the myeloma setting? PSA, again, is an example that's been around for quite some time. But there are a number of other potential biomarkers that could be used to guide treatment decisions in real time, whether it's imaging or biochemical or otherwise. And circulating tumor cells, for example, have been on the radar for quite some time. I don't know if they've ever kind of really reached prime time other than in the form of as a means to quantitate and provide prognostic guidance as opposed to decision-making value. What is the state of science? Again, with circulating tumor cells, are there other biomarkers in development that we can talk about? And then again, the implications for intervention. So if there are a number of different resistance mechanisms to checkpoint inhibitors, for example, is a drug company going to go out and develop a drug that targets any one of them? The case may be more clear-cut when you have a tyrosine kinase that mutates and evolves in the presence of a first-line therapy, and you can develop a second-line therapy. But in the case of immuno-oncology, it's going to be more complex, as we're already learning. So just I took one quick analytic set of data here that I wanted to present. And thanks to Defined Health Analysts and Vishal and Isundaram in particular, who helped generate this. The question for looking at the anti-PD-1 and PD-L1 phase 3 trials that are currently listed in clinicaltrials.gov, we asked the question of whether or not they include a biomarker. And for the ones that do, what is that biomarker? And this data may not come as a surprise to many of you in the field. About a third of the trials do include a biomarker, the overwhelming majority of which are looking at PD-L1. And these aren't just biomarkers in the exploratory fashion, which by the time you get to phase 3 isn't generally the case anyway. These are biomarkers included in the inclusion-exclusion criteria. But as I'm sure we'll get into, there are a number of other biomarkers that could predict potentially whether a patient is going to respond to a particular immuno-oncology agent or not. Is PD-L1 rising to the surface of phase 3 and we have a sea change coming behind that? Or are we still kind of stuck with PD-L1 no matter where you look in the pipeline? And then to break down this data a little bit further, when you look at the trials that are looking at PD-L1 or using PD-L1 as a biomarker or not, by tumor type and by company, and you can email me later if you want these slides, or I presume they'll be available for distribution. You can start to see some patterns that emerge. So, for example, looking at melanoma, which PD-L1 doesn't really seem to be very predictive versus non-small cell lung, where PD-L1 has been demonstrated to have some value. You can also see, peeking up from the noise, certain corporate foci like Merck's biomarker focus and Roche's as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to my panel and start asking them some questions, or at least asking some of the questions that I may have. And the panel, I'm not going to really ask them to introduce themselves because I think you have their bios, and I don't want to waste time. We have three members from diagnostic companies. We have an academic, and we have Leora.
A consultant with biomarker experience.
And what we don't have on here, as you can see, is pharma or industry. So you are the sixth panelist out there, audience members, and I invite you to ask questions and push back on anything that, we have to say here. All right. So I think we should start with patient selection, and then maybe we'll come back to screening. So for patient selection, and maybe I'll start with Liara on the end, who wrote an excellent piece in the Timmerman Report not too long ago on the different biomarkers that are available potentially to identify patients that are going to be sensitive or not to immuno-oncology. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but maybe you can talk to me a little bit about why, when you look at the phase 3 studies, all we see is PD-L1. And should we see other things coming up behind that in the future, or are we not going to get much further?
Well, if I can take a step back from that, the article that I wrote looked at potential pathways that may be implicated in the performance of checkpoint inhibitors. And it's very interesting. When you consider patient selection based on biomarkers, what the biomarker is providing is probabilistic information about whether a patient might benefit or not from a treatment. And what we're finding is, even with the selection, we have a certain proportion of patients who either never respond or who ultimately relapse. And so the question is, what's going on with those patients? And in a way, I almost find that the more interesting question, because we have a pool of patients that potentially could be addressable with immunotherapies, but something's going on. And so the point of my article was looking at what might be gumming up the works. What are other pathways that might be implicated? And it's really important when we think about cancer not to look at individual pathways or even individual systems like the immune system. It's a systems biology approach that will help us look at all the factors that can be interacting. And so it may be that you've got a marvelous immunotherapy, but over here, you may have a driver mutation that is doing something that is interfering. Maybe you have a problem with your microbiome where you're missing certain component species that normally would stimulate immune performance. So there are a lot of different factors going on. And so why everybody's looking at PD-L1, it's been defined. It's an easy thing to do. It's already a test out there, so obviously people are going to look at it. Is that sufficiently indicative of whether or not somebody's going to respond? The answer is no. In some cases, for some drug trials, the most that they found was it would be a companion diagnostic that would add information. It was not definitive. And there's a distinction between a complementary diagnostic test and a companion. A companion, from a regulatory standpoint, is required in order to safely treat a patient with a given drug. A companion provides additional information. And so you have these PD-L1 tests that run the gamut. So clearly, we need a better profile of patients who are being considered for these therapies.
What a good setup for Alessandra.
Yes, if I may add a few things. I actually think that the reason why people went to PD-L1 is because the checkpoint inhibitor were actually against the PD-1 and PD-L1 pathway. So essentially there is the thinking about going against the target. And the immunohistochemistry is a very well established. And so when we are talking about assays, you know, giving access to the drug to the patient, that's where people are actually going. I also think in that PD-L1, knowing the biology, is actually a surrogate. It's telling you that there is a pre-existing adaptive immunity that is peripheral B may be suppressed through that mechanism. So that was one of the reasons why people went there. But I think that the problems were biologically, because the immune system is actually heterogeneous at the level of the tissue, but is also longitudinal, meaning temporary, as essentially a wave of things happening. So essentially we can just miss it. And that is one of the problems of the negative predictive value of the PD-L1 as a marker is relatively low. And that is essentially the reason why when you are using it for a third line selection of patients, meaning patients that have failed any other kind of therapy, you can't really afford to deny a therapy to a patient that could benefit, and that's why we got the complementary thing. So the complementary comes more because of the failure, if you want, of having a good negative predictive value in the marker than really comes from the drug in general, and that's true. But when you move to early line of therapy, like first line, like Merck did, then it changes because essentially you have a comparator, and so you need to select a population that does as well, at least as the comparator of above. So, but talking about the limitation of a single biomarker when looking at complex system, the other are technical, immunohistochemistry, and the other thing is, to be honest, the fact that we as a society, follow the one drug, one marker, one analyte. And so we end up with four or five different tests measuring the same thing with different not comparability between each other. Right. And that creates a very big, even if they try through the blueprint to compare it. But although the comparison of this antibody and platform and cutoff are true for the tumor cell, they are not true for when you start to measure them at the level of the immune cell. So this really doesn't create a lot of access to patient at the end and creates a lot of confusion. So in this environment in which, based on all these different limitations, we really think, because of what also was said, that the immune system is a system, and not only, but it's working together with the tumor. And so you need to study the tumor too. There is not just only a component. There is a host, right, that is part. So that we need to look actually a multiplex information, meaning we need to look at the very different aspect of this interaction. And we need to integrate this data so that at the end you have a more complete, holistic picture of it.
Yeah, and it bears stating the obvious, which is IO is a fundamentally different treatment paradigm than the targeted therapy and Absolutely. Chemotherapy of the past.
That's
even the randomized.
It's not binary.
I'll get to you, Ken.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So I just want to comment a little bit on the history. So by background, a pathologist. So I've been doing this for a long time, and I was involved in the original PD-L1 study, so I helped define some of those early cutoffs and did some of the early looking.
Yeah, you're the one.
But I'll take us back to when I was a resident in the early 80s. And in breast cancer, we had Laura's nice talk, but we had an entity called medullary carcinoma of the breast that we knew was densely infiltrated with a lymphoplasmacytic infiltrate. We knew those patients did better. Now, we didn't know why. We just said stage for stage, these people did better. We now know that they're triple negative patients, that they are frequently associated with BRCA1 abnormalities. We saw the same thing in colon cancer. We knew there was a difference between left-sided and right-sided colon cancer. This is back 30, 35 years ago. We knew these observations. What was the big differentiator? We knew that when the colon cancer was infiltrated by lymphocytes, we called it intraepithelial lymphocytosis, that those patients did better. They were a hallmark of right-sided colon cancer. We now know that that's just a hallmark of microsatellite instability. So all of these things have come full circle. We saw these things back looking at an H&E slide with no diagnostic tests, nothing. We knew that these people did better. We just didn't understand why. So when you come forward, and now we've sort of recognized that immune system was important, we sort of took ourselves out when genomics came into being, right? So that medullary carcinoma of the breast just went away, right? When we had ER, PR, and HER2, it just became, it's a triple negative breast cancer, right? Gets mixed up in everything else that's going on. When we talk about testing for PD-L1, and you said it brilliantly, really what we're talking about is there an adaptive immune response? And there's many different ways that we can detect that. PD-L1 is one. Just looking at the slide and looking at tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes is another. We can look at tumor mutational burden. We can go on and on and on to ask that fundamental question, is there an adaptive immune response? And if so, might that patient benefit from checkpoint inhibition therapy? Now, we know that whatever we're picking isn't good enough. So the thing of the day is, what if we do it in combination? What if we do tumor mutation burden with PD-L1? What if we do tumor infiltrating lymphocytes with whatever else is going on? The other thing that I just want to point out as a pathologist is all of the testing that's done is based on some section of that tumor that we select. And unfortunately, there's heterogeneity in that selection, and we don't have uniform criteria even how we go about taking those sections to begin with. So there's a randomness to the process. So it shouldn't be overly shocking to people that when we call a biomarker as negative, that might just be due to our selection. And that holds whether it's in breast cancer for estrogen receptor or HER2, or whether it's in small cell lung cancer, for example, for PD-L1.
Great. Lisa, I'm dying to hear what you have to say.
I guess I'd like to build on what my colleagues have pointed out, that I think where we're at in the field is we've seen some wonderful signals. And the signals are, is it a hot or a cold tumor? And that's the same as there's an infiltrate or not. And that can be, we can refine that with the immunoscore and look at an invasive margin or localization, relationships between effectors and suppressors, but it's an immune infiltrate. And we can, I can't imagine doing a PD-1 study, some sort of combination study without doing a PD-L1 test, partly because whoever gave me the drug would probably insist on it. But we also need to keep gathering all these data to find out where that's a really effective biomarker. But another signal that I think is super important is tumor mutation burden, because that speaks to the number of unique antigens and the quality of the T cell we can elicit to those antigens. And so, some people call it tumor mutation burden, antigen spread. I think of it as determinant spreading from one antigen to multiple antigens as the tumor breaks open in a cross-presentation process. But that's also looking at the breadth of the antigen response. And as we think about T cell therapies in the last panel, next generation is talking about multiple targets. So I think these are all profiles of a tumor that will or will not respond. And by profiling these with multiple biomarkers, then we're going to identify who needs what. And if we see, the perfect tumor, it's a hot tumor, it's fully infiltrated, there's a lot of PD-L1, then, that points us in a direction. And until we have more than a really good plan A of PD-1 blockade, then everyone's going to get plan A, whether they're a good candidate for it or not. But once we have even more therapies in our armamentarium, then when we see the perfect PD-1 patient, that's what they'll get. But when we see the very much not perfect PD-1 patient, then we'll have other things to choose from, and that'll be guided. So I feel like we're in very much a profiling state in the field where we need to gather the PD-L1 data, but tumor and infiltrate. We need to get the mutation burden and the antigen profile. We need to look at the spatial relationship of the cells to each other in addition to the RNA expression profile. So, and all of that will then finally, we'll gather those data and we'll refine it. And then we'll know what we're looking for. But I don't think we know that yet.
Right. So we're talking about a fundamentally different label. I can imagine if you're a drug company out there, and I would love for anyone to speak up about this. It's one thing to incorporate a bunch of different exploratory biomarkers into your phase 2 proof of concept study, and then to potentially see a signal retrospectively. But then to make the decision about including, excluding, or even just balancing study arms so that you can prospectively detect an effect in patients that are positive or negative for composite biomarkers X, Y, and Z. has to greatly muddy the water in the development process. It may be, and it, scientifically, it is where we need to go. But I question commercially whether we're going to go there. So if anyone out there has a question about that or a comment, please speak up. James. No, just speak up.
I'll just talk. So I have a question about the, you know, the PD-L1. I know every company has their own PD-L1 diagnostic, you know, and I'm sure Adaptive and in NanoString, everyone has their own kind of version of this. But you know, I've seen Genentech; they always talk about the immune cell versus the tumor cell, and they even, you know, discuss how they think it's more immune cell versus. But I'm just wondering, what is it really? I mean, I've seen also papers how in preclinical models, if you remove the PD-L1 from the tumor, the PD-L1 antibody still works. So maybe it's not important in the tumor cell. It's more important in the immune cell. Are you guys really going to figure that out? And then are we going to have some sort of standardization at some point?
So I can talk a little bit to some of that, I guess. You know, to me, the main question is whether there's an adaptive immune response to, say, do checkpoint inhibitors play? And the PD-L1 is, in my mind, a little bit of a distraction in that process. It's one measure that there is an adaptive immune response there. Now, the problem with PD-L1 expression and it not working in all organ systems is it just tells you that it's an adaptive immune response. It doesn't tell you there's an adaptive immune response to the tumor, right? That just means there was an antigen and your immune cell was reacting to that antigen. So you move into the lung where we're clearing things that we're inhaling all the time, and maybe that response isn't necessarily to a tumor. So the concept, let me just back up a little bit to the concept of a tumor neoantigen. So the idea is that tumors have mutations. Those mutations will lead to the aberrant expression of protein, but not all mutations lead to aberrant expression of protein. Right, they're not just active. Many of those mutations, for example, are just passengers that are never expressed. So you need that aberrant protein to be expressed, and if you have that antigen, when it's expressed, has to be presented to your immune system. It does that through things called the MHC classes. So, for example, I can have an antigen that would be presented in me, but it wouldn't be presented in you. So just because you're creating that foreign protein does not guarantee that you're going to create an immunogenic response in that patient. In fact, one of the things that we do at Human Longevity that we've studied is we not just sequence the entire genome of the tumor, we then do the RNA expression so you can see which of those mutations are actually being expressed. And then we actually culture that with the patient's PBMCs to see, is the patient eliciting a response to that neoantigen? So we actually synthesize the peptides to our predicted neoantigens, and then we can culture that with the patient's blood and see specifically, do we get a response? And what you see is for that vast amount of potential neoantigen that's present, much fewer are actually expressed, and there's only a tiny subset that are actually being recognized in individuals. So it's a very complicating situation. So what you see with things like tumor mutational burden or microsatellite instability is basically buying a lottery ticket. What are the odds that the antigen that you presented is being expressed and is going to be recognized by your immune system? The more tickets you buy, the more likely that is. And in some cases, it's so likely you've bought so many lottery tickets that you can't lose, right? So that's in essence the so-called microsatellite instability, or that might be where we go with the tumor mutational burden. If we discuss things like tumor mutational burden, we get into the same issue that we got into with PD-L1, that you've got different varieties of those. So then the question becomes, well, what's tumor mutational burden? It depends on the types of mutations that you've looked for and the extent. So did you look at 30 genes? Did you look at 500 genes? Did you look at the whole exome? Did you look at the whole genome? And those numbers are different. Just to give you some number difference, a standard tumor that we would look at in Human Longevity by whole genome sequencing would have about 25,000 mutations on average. If I did an exome, that would be 800-900 mutations on average. If you looked at your typical Foundation Medicine report that you would get back clinically, you'll see 3, 4, maybe 5 mutations. So the question is, are those the five that are relevant out of the 25,000 that were really present within the whole genome? If it's predictive, if you run a clinical trial and it's predictive, then it's an appropriate biomarker. But don't confuse the biomarker necessarily with science.
Yeah, and if I may, I think that that's all very much true, and there is another complication on the top, that even if you have an adaptive response peripherally suppressed, it doesn't mean that an anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 is the mechanism that actually suppresses that immune response. There are a lot of other checkpoints inhibitor, there are a lot of regulatory cells that can be parsed. So you can have a hot tumor and as the PD-L1 and as high mutation burden, but does not, when you inhibit only that pathway, like as monotherapy, it's not going to change the situation. So understanding really the biology, the mechanism of immune evasion that are operating at the level of the single patient in one single assay, ideally, because otherwise you have to have tons of tissue to run all the different, is really the best way of really cracking the nuts, if you want, and understanding at the level of the single patient, not of the population, what is the mechanism of immune evasion.
If I may, there is the converse with tumor mutation burden. Just because you don't see it doesn't mean that you may not necessarily benefit. And there's an example that I found with clear cell renal cell carcinoma, where these patients have very low tumor mutation burden, but they have a silencing mutation in their chromosome structural complex that apparently facilitates the immune presentation. And so they do very well with PD-L1 inhibition. And so I think it gets back to the issue that one biomarker is not going to get you a comprehensive view of what to do with a patient in front of you. And the question becomes, how many different pieces of information do we really need in order to get at more and more patients who may potentially benefit? What is that additional information that's required?
So with an unlimited amount of funds, I think we could get to the bottom of all these things, but I keep coming back to the fact that there's a commercial case to be made. So I want to bring Sharon into the conversation as our business development voice on the panel, and one who I'm guessing engages a fair amount with the therapeutics industry and other end users. Tell me about the push and pull between the commercial and the science and the unmet need.
Absolutely. If I may, I'll just focus on the science and sort of our thinking and the way we view the world. Certainly PD-L1 put biomarkers for IO on the map, so that is definitely great progress. The way we see the world is from the adaptive immune system is, unlike historically, biomarkers have been more of a binary, on-off, you have it or you don't, and there may be a magnitude of having it. The goal for us is to really look at the host immune response as a dynamic change that's also temporal. So at that point in time, you take a snapshot, and we sequence basically the immune system and specifically in IO T-cell receptors. And from that pan T-cell view, our assay also helps prognosticate but also predict the patients at higher likelihood of response. And to go back to Leora's sort of concept of systems, sort of system of the immune system, is that patient ready and immune competent to be able to be screened into a trial, to go back to your point about PD-L1 screening. From a business model perspective, I think the realities and really the challenges of PD-L1 are such that we forget that it takes thousands, literally, there were thousands of patients initially screened until you get that 300 or 400, if that, into the clinical trial. And so that's a huge burden on sort of our pharma partners, and there are interests to incorporate and integrate other biomarkers, such as not only tissue-based, but we know that's rate limiting, but also peripheral blood-based. And our TCR beta assay also looks at the peripheral blood and clonality or clonal expansion, which speaks back to dynamics. So in terms of commercialization, in general, I think it goes back to perhaps less of a CDX approach and much more, as you mentioned, a complementary diagnostic approach. I think it also that also enables perhaps less of a commitment right away from the pharma biotech partners and being more flexible and nimble to perhaps consider incorporating these biomarkers earlier and not just one, but maybe a few to get to that proof of concept and be able to consider a commercial path that's not sort of locked into a CDX, which requires a lot more investment from the both entities.
Right. Does that then potentially also spill into the treatment algorithm itself in terms of, you know, I guess I distinguish between patient selection and real-time adaptive treatment decisions, but I guess you could blur the lines in the case of the immune system.
Especially. A little bit, yes. So the screening I'll give you our most advanced, as you mentioned and showed a slide on minimal residual disease. There you can screen for MRD positive patients in the heme malignancies, both IO agents, but also cell therapy. So that's a screening approach, but you can also monitor, and that's the complementary diagnostic piece that's, again, we partnered, and that's a commercially viable option. Our TCR-beta assay is also clinic-ready, and similarly, you can, by looking at TIL infiltration and clonality, perhaps screen into a study those that are immune-competent, and you can also perhaps predict. So those are models that can be commercial, but focusing on complementary.
Great. Lisa?
So to touch on some points and a question for Sharon to build on points that Ken made, so when we think about tumor mutation burden, there's all the data, whole genome sequencing, then the expressed genes, epitopes, what's actually processed and presented, which is critical if we want to vaccinate. But the hotspot mutations, that foundation medicine, is an approximation, and it gives us an idea. A lot of mutations, not a lot of mutations. So I know as a scientist, I'm desperate to know what the antigen is. But do you really need to know what the antigen is?
Everybody wants to know what the antigen is, especially because of mutation information, that's not going to go away as a marker. Especially, obviously, in solid tumors. So, absolutely, I think the idea is going from a macro level, what T cells metrics are there, and then honing in on antigen specificity, which we can also do and are helping vaccine companies in that front. But that's hugely relevant, basically, in terms of, to your point, a driver mutation. Not all mutations are perhaps relevant, and so which ones are actually driving an immune response.
So I'd like to just add a little bit of information to the commercial aspect. What makes diagnostics so incredibly difficult? The first thing I want to mention is how billing occurs for diagnostic tests. And historically, if you're not familiar with this, it's kind of crazy. There are things called CPT codes, which are required when you submit a claim. And what these are, CPT stands for Current Procedural Terminology. And the procedural says it all. These tests are treated as procedures. They're not individualized. And so it's very difficult to make a value case. It's been difficult over time. What do you mean that your immunoassay has more value than this one? You're doing the same procedure. And so historically, diagnostic tests have been reimbursed at very low rates, which has not supported innovation. There are more complex CPT codes that have evolved in the face of molecular diagnostics, but they're still generic. And so it's been very difficult to make quality claims across different tests. There is an innovation that occurred a number of years ago. Two organizations came together, McKesson Health Solutions and Palmetto GBA, which is one of the MACs, the Medicare administrative contractors. And they said, well, we need to know what this particular test is doing uniquely. And they came up with Z codes, which are unique identifiers. And those allow you to actually look at the performance of individual tests. So that's a step in the right direction. The other thing I want to mention is that when payers look at tests, FDA looks at two things. They look at technical validity. Does your test measure whatever analyte you say you're going to measure? Then they look at clinical validity. Does what is being measured indicate a disease condition, an outcome, something clinically valid? Great. If you pass those two hurdles, they will approve. Payers want to know clinical utility. Does it matter if the test is run? Will a doctor act on it? Will it change a decision? And then ultimately, will it change outcomes? And these are tremendously difficult things to prove and very costly to prove with prospective studies. And so this is part of what has made this a very challenging area.
No, sure. So they are difficult to prove unless they are in the context of a companion diagnostic. Because in the context of a companion diagnostic, you are actually means you are selecting the patient using that, or prospectively, or you have a retrospective, prospective kind of design, but you show that there is a particular population that when treated that way is actually getting an outcome benefit. It becomes a problem in the complementary diagnostic, because in the complementary diagnostic, you are actually running, like for instance, well, we have a lot of examples because there are a lot of them that have been approved the way, like a PD-L1 complementary in melanoma and in lung for some of the indication. In that particular case, the drug win, quote unquote, in the old population. However, when you run the test, you can see that the benefits, although not uniquely, but is definitely concentrated in a group of patients, and this is where there is benefits for those patients is higher. However, you cannot, the negative predictive value is not zero. So there are some patients that even if they were negative for the test, they respond for it. That's why you get the complementary. The problem is actually to get a reimbursement in a situation of such, because the pharma will essentially say, you don't need to run the test, because you don't. It's a complementary thing. And so essentially the payers start wondering about. But to me, that is a risk, because when you actually look at the results of this data, very few people actually do, but even in the label, you can actually see that there are subset of patients that actually do worse if they don't have essentially the marker. And the mini do worse than essentially the comparator, for instance, a chemotherapy or whatever is the standard of care. And so to me, we always assume that if patients do not benefit, they at least are not doing worse. But we are seeing interesting things now with immuno-oncology drugs. So I think we need to have a better grasp around understanding which patient benefit from which treatment, in particular when we go in combination. I mean, we can't be empirical in combination because the mechanisms of immune evasion are so many, and we are at the risk of really running out of patients. We are doing a disfavor to them, but really creating situation in which we can do harm.
Right. And you also have workflow. So it's great to talk about the tests, but the tests have to fit into a laboratory workflow as well. Right. So lung cancer is probably the best example where many lung cancers are taken with either a fine needle aspirate or a very small core needle biopsy. And then the question is, well, how much tissue do you have to run all these tests? And you frequently run out of tissue for that. So then it's a question of priority, right? So are you going to do, for example, an EGFR test first, an ALK test first? Could you run a larger molecular panel? If you run a larger molecular panel, maybe you get tumor mutational burden for free. So it didn't cost you anything really to get that. You might charge for it. But the fact is, out of the tissue that you have, what's the value that you can extract out of it? If it's a large tumor and you have, in essence, infinite tissue, then that's less of a concern. But for things like melanoma, non-small cell lung cancer, et cetera, tissue does play an issue in that.
Since your title is Reading the Future, what essentially you're saying, in the future you will need to have an assay that actually characterizes the disease in all the aspects of biology, including the immunological one, so that you have one stop in which you just don't do it because of a drug in mind, but you do. You characterize the disease and you have essentially a scorecard of in which you can actually then choose the therapy for
right.
That.
So let me extrapolate that just for 1 second. We talked about heterogeneity earlier. Mm-hmm. So if that's all you're taking is a tiny fragment of that tumor, and that's all the testing that's going to be done, and the results of those tests determine all therapy, how many patients are you going to misclassify by missing that mutation that was still present elsewhere in the tumor, that PD-L1 expression that might have been elsewhere?
That's why you need the orthogonal methodology for actually, or orthogonal measurement.
Let me just cut in because we're getting deep in the weeds, and I want to pull it back a little bit. Brian, maybe you can do that for us.
Okay, Joe. So I wanted to try to pull a number of the aspects Anil has raised simply from the viewpoint of a practicing clinician. So if you remember, 2,000 years ago, medicine was defined as an art, not as a science. And it became this.
Because because patients with ER of 8%, 10%, 15% respond poorly. Patients with 70, 80% respond well. If you have a low progesterone receptor, they don't work as well. If you have ER in the presence of HER2 or in SARC, it doesn't work as well. So we look at Ki-67. We look at Oncotype. Everyone's desperately been looking for cutoffs for Oncotype, but it is an absolute continuum. So does a PD-L1 inhibitor work if you've got MDM2 or MDM4? Does it work if you don't have TILs? What do? We do a combination of MSI, TMB, TILs, etc. So we work basically on continuums. So the second thing is context is utterly critical. So you can take an FM report, and if you've got P10 null, and if you've got PP2RA1 there, which is a phosphatase which blocks and accelerates AKT, it doesn't work. BRAF V600E in colorectal does not work because you've got upregulation of EGFR. So everything is utterly contextual. So I believe, and this is going to be provocative, that companion diagnostics is effectively dead, per se. We use routinely Foundation One, Foundation Act, NanoString. We use your immune panel. We use a whole variety of platforms. And Ken, as you know, they will progress to whole exome. RNA-seq is going to become dominant. We'll move into proteomics. So I think we're going to have a lot more platforms that will inform way and above over routine pathology. But I think the whole idea of trying to do a match of one molecular signal against one matching drug will not work.
And I think that's what I was trying to get at, sort of the realities of the future. But also what that raises and speaks to is that it's not just in the targeted, you know, therapy space, which is great. We had CDX, but I think the FDA and the regulatory environment is such that they are open to other pathways. And there are other commercialization pathways as well. And so together, based on the various novel and new technologies that evolve and that get implemented and actually have clinical utility and value, I think that's sort of the cautious optimism around incorporating biomarkers and diagnostics.
You know, it's interesting that even with companion diagnostics, there's a question of clinical utility. A lot of doctors ignore the result from HER2 because there are HER2 negative patients mm-hmm. who do benefit. And they're starting to tease out why that's happening. And so, again, this gets back to the fact that single markers are just probability indicators and that there's so much more going on.
Absolutely. And that if you...
And Dennis Slamon actually said that doing HER2 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus was the worst thing he ever did. And the best correlation is still against HER2 mRNA transcript, and that's not even used chemically. And Ken, you're a pathologist. Yeah. You can say that's wrong or right.
No, it's absolutely right. The problem with the MRA has always been the pre-analytics around it, not right. So it is all of it is good, but you have to transform it into the current clinical space.
Yep.
So we're dealt with formalin fixed paraffin embedded tissue.
Yep.
We're dealt with how operating rooms handle tissue and move them to pathology. Mm-hmm. Things like cold ischemic time and other things, which have effect on some of the things that we would like to measure. So it's back to what I said. We've got to get it into a workflow. When the workflow is that we're going to do whole exome sequencing or a Foundation Medicine panel routinely on a tumor, the only question that's going to be raised is, how do you select the block for that analysis? Because we know if you select a different block, you're going to get some different results.
Question.
I have a question on the other end from where Brian started, not when do you start, but when do you stop some treatments? And I think in these early days of PD-1, I may be mistaken, but I think it's still empiric. It's the way we used to do it with chemotherapy. If the study was done treating for 6 months or for a year, that's how long you treat the patient. But maybe going back to the keynote we had, you know, there may be patients who are very sensitive and only need a couple courses. So how close do you think we are to being able to look for MRD, not just in the liquid malignancies, but, you know, I think this new results with lung cancer are going to be quite transformative. Do all of those patients need a year of treatment, or will we start to see screening for either circulating tumor cells or circulating tumor DNA and deciding to stop treatment when that is no longer detectable?
Yeah. So interesting questions. I think the data will tell us what will play out. Screening for MRD in solid malignancies isn't that much of a problem if you've done extensive sequencing and you know what to look for. The beauty in the hematological malignancies is we know what's driving it, so it's easy to look for that translocation in blood. A little bit tougher in solid tumors because many of the solid tumor drivers that we look for are not necessarily drivers in other areas. For example, if you have a nevus on your skin, the odds are that there's a BRAF 600E mutation in it. Scratch it, you probably put BRAF 600E into your blood. Now, is that going to be indicative of following, for example, your colon cancer or your melanoma? I don't know. The other problem with ctDNA is, of course, that is DNA from dying cells. And so if you've got metastatic disease and you have tumor throughout your body, which DNA do you care about, the DNA in the cells that are growing or the DNA in the cells that are dying? And do they, in fact, mirror each other? So I think there's a lot of work. The data will tell us whether we can do these things. I think should we be looking at those sorts of things? Absolutely. You have to. But, you know, for example, we routinely have looked at friends of family that have, you know, a solid malignancy that we've done extensive sequencing on. We will find the unique mutations in them and then look at them in blood. It's easy to monitor for minimal residual disease. Now, are you going to create a custom assay for every person in your clinical practice? Probably not, because you couldn't cost justify it. But that's only a matter of time.
So this will be my last comment. I mean, I think the one thing that pulls Ken, yourself, Bob, and myself together is continuous monitoring is going to become the norm.
Have to.
And we will flex therapies according to continuous monitoring. So we've now got in our own HER2 positive series a 45% conversion rate from HER2 negative into HER2 positive when you go from adjuvant into metastatic liver cancer.
So one interesting thing, as we start to look at things like the liquid biopsies, is what these tests are telling us. And one of the concerns I have with all of these different modalities is are patients going to get different treatment recommendations depending on which test they get? And there was a study that looked at just that. And so one of the problems that FDA's actually flagged this, in the past month, there were three new draft guidance documents that FDA published. One of them was on next-gen sequencing. And they flagged issues that were hurdles to getting accelerated approvals for these new technologies, which Gottlieb very much wants and supports. And what the guidance identified was the lack of consensus standards, which we desperately need in order to see, does this test by this manufacturer get the same result as this one? And even if you're using the same platforms, does this lab get the same result as this one? And until we get to that point, there, you can be sure that payers are going to be reticent about paying for these, and doctors about trusting them. And so I think that's a fundamental.
Absolutely.
Sorry, I just want to bring Lisa into the conversation because I have a question, and maybe it takes us a little bit away from the current topic, but I don't think so. So PD-1, PD-L1 antibodies, patients respond, then they relapse. There are resistance mechanisms. There are a number of them out there. Is there a coherent theme emerging? Will there ever be a coherent theme emerging as such that we can prescribe therapies for patients that are developing resistance mechanism X, therapy Y? Or is it going to continue to be, which I think is what's playing out and what we see certainly with in our work at Defined Health, is novel settings, unmet needs opening up in the PD-L1 or the anti-PD-1 resistance setting and layering on PD-1 plus adjunct X and looking to see empirically if we get a signal in the resistant patients.
I guess my read of the literature is that I think the resistance mechanisms are going to shake out into pathways as well, and that, you know, we'll be able to screen for molecules and you know, RNA expression profiles that are indicative of specific pathways. And I like to think as we're, you know, at least psychically reading the future, that the circulating tumor DNA, when we know what to look for, you know, whether it's DNA molecular profiling or proteomics in the blood, that when we, you know, when we've narrowed the field to these themes and profiles, we're going to be able to, you know, draw that one tube of blood and find, you know, all of those pathways that are being shed by the tumor, and, you know, maybe not proximal to the therapy, but, you know, that's an average. It's going to be an average, and I think that's going to help address some of the tumor heterogeneity points that have been raised that are critical in the tumor world. But once we get back to the blood, we have sensitive enough technologies that we're going to be able to identify these themes and then go from there. That's the fantasy.
Might be a fantasy. I hope it's not. I hope it's not. But I think that there needs to be a note of caution that many of the things that we're measuring in blood, we don't have that reproducibility yet. We don't have other things. There's a number of very good interventional radiology studies, too, where you draw blood directly leaving the tumor, blood entering the tumor, blood from peripheral veins, and they don't show the same analytes within ctDNA. So that's very problematic. It's like, when do you measure? Where do you measure? How do you measure? All the uniformity around it. I agree with you. We need to strive to get there, but it's not
technology problems.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
It's not going to happen probably in 3 months or 6 months. It's a bigger problem than that.
Yeah, we have a comment from our.
Yeah, I was just going to say though, for all these things, you know, trying to figure out how to standardize this across multiple sites is important. But if something is so fragile that the technical requirements are so difficult, it's not robust and ready for prime time. Right. You know, I think that once, you know, I think I'm struck by, you know, some things like if you're injecting and you're seeing things that we're looking for as like big wins. I mean, I mean, I know about the, you know, the analytic variability, but I think it's important that we get things to a point that they're relatively robust. you know. Otherwise, right. I don't see it's going to be too hard to compare, and it's just going to create a big mess. I mean, wouldn't you all agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I keep coming back to that, which is our flashlight is becoming more focused, and
yeah.
Maybe it's becoming a laser pointer.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, is it actionable, or are we just continuing to unearth increasingly granular reality? And there's a limit to how much that information can be actionable versus academic.
And it's interesting that we started out, like an ice bite, doing frozen only because, you know, 10 years ago, you couldn't do, I mean, the irony is that all the immune multiplexing is done on paraffin, standardized around paraffin, which is just really hurts my feelings because we have this fabulous bank of frozen tissue. But we're being forced to convert to paraffin. But actually, at the end of the day, it's having a signal that rises above that in a robust way is probably the right thing to do anyway.
Yeah, Jim.
I think that's not very new. I remember hearing this even myself for a long time, and none of these have been really, when tested in an appropriate context, not just anecdotally, have shown to be, at least with the kind of therapy that were available during that period of time, have not been very much predictive of anything. When really tested, as I say, in the context of something that is controlled. So I don't know about the one that you are referring particularly right now.
Yeah, I don't know the one you're referring to either, but, you know, as you've said, there have been many companies that they've generally not been very predictive of what does work. They've been more predictive of what doesn't work.
That is the majority of things. Yeah. So it's very easy to predict something that happened to 90% of the case versus the 10%. So essentially it's...
Yeah, they've had good luck, but it's only a year and a half old.
So in the waning minutes leading up to lunch, I just want to chat a little bit about screening. And I guess if you think about this as a continuum, you know, we've been talking about patient selection. Jeff mentioned in his opening talk about positioning of these therapies earlier and earlier in the adjuvant setting. I mentioned smoldering myeloma, and then perhaps even beyond, even earlier into the healthy population, which has been very fraught. But as I mentioned, there is demand for that, at least, you know, if you ask the average person why we're not identifying cancer before it happens. Many of us in the room understand that there's a lot of issues with that, but is that ever going to be a reality? And if so, is it going to be widespread? Is it going to be particular examples? I'm looking at Ken, but I guess my question is for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to go back to some of the things that Laura said this morning that are easy ones. So things like, you know, doing routine whole exome sequencing of germline will identify many predisposing high-risk genes. Developing polygenic risk scores become absolutely critical to understand what individual risks are before they're selected to screening, because I'm not sure that there is, as Laura said, one screening method for everybody. You need to risk stratify. And then we can move that on to, you know, the attempts with companies like Grail, Freenome, and others. You know, can we find early evidence of tumor and then somehow identify it? You're still going to have to do some sort of imaging study and move forward that. I guess, you know, I'm excited by the sorts of things that those companies are doing, but I wonder if imaging companies might not be better suited toward that early detection of lesions. I know that they have to be big to be identified, but molecular imaging techniques, et cetera, that might target what we can go after.
I agree. GRAIL and leveraging still RNA-seq at Adaptive. We announced a partnership in January, which has been the culmination of launching Adaptive over 7 years ago, which is basically building a universal TCR antigen map. So, Lisa, that goes back to antigen specificity. But the goal is early detection from a simple blood test. And basically combining our antigen specificity platform of TCR and what they recognize with the power of Microsoft's machine learning and building that map. We've prioritized tumors such as ovarian cancer, which is high unmet need amongst others, as well as other therapeutic areas. Of course, the focus here is oncology. And we believe that it's possible, and so that's what we're really setting out to do quite aggressively and investing significantly to do so. The jury will be out, and the goal is just, we've said it, tissue is limiting. And so I think it's those innovative technologies and thinking around how can we leverage peripheral blood, cell-free DNA, et cetera.
Dr. Esserman, not to call you out, but are you concerned that we're going to do all this work only to find more idle tumors out there?
Absolutely. So I think there are two issues that I would bring up. One is at $135 a test, screening mammography costs around $10 billion a year. So if you're thinking about a repetitive test that's $500 or $400, now you're going to be spending $40 billion a year. So I think, again, you have to think about what's the population you're going to look for. Now, if you said, look, I want to take that high-risk population for whom we are not succeeding, take the top 2.5% of the population, and now I'm going to focus, you know, a test like GRAIL or something like that, which, by the way, it takes more blood than I lose in the operating room. But, I think that if you've got to think about, again, who's going to benefit and what's the burden, and you have to make sure that you're really focusing on finding consequential cancers. I think that that's a huge problem. You know, when people say, oh, I can find cancer when it's a cell big, I said, please, don't. You want to find the, because your body, I'm sure, Lisa, you could say the same thing. You know, we come up with these things and get rid of them probably all the time. We're just not seeing that. You know, so you don't want to get it before you've had a chance to figure that out. But maybe there's certain phenotypes, like people who are, share maybe the work you're doing, trying to find, well, who actually has a defect when things are coming up. One last thing I would say is you think about a lot of these fields converging. You know, the fields of MS and the people who have autoimmune disease, you know, again, you're seeing the opposite of the IO, right? You're trying to, do these immune suppression, which are really quite the opposite. But you see in these big studies, people aren't getting cancer right and left. So it's probably not a predisposition. So the suppression of the immune system alone is not sufficient. And it probably has something to do with the fact that the cancers themselves that arise have this innate ability to suppress the immune system along that way. So it may not be, that's sort of, I think, to me, one of the clues that we're not going to necessarily find that innate system. But the place to look is once you know who's at risk for what kind of cancer, to start delving in and doing a deep dive and that smaller population where you actually might have a chance of finding a signal.
You have 2 minutes for your rebuttal. No, I'm kidding. Anyone on the panel want to respond to that?
Actually, I just want to make a comment. I think one of the biggest hurdles to getting into this new paradigm is going to be attitudes, not just of patients, but of physicians. And I've had interesting conversations about the issue of overdiagnosis with some very fine physicians who would argue back that we can't afford to miss any patients. And so what's a biopsy if we can... No understanding of what the impact is societally in terms of cost, in terms of harm to patients. It was an attitude that we had to catch every single cancer we could. And so I think there's a real shift that has to happen, not just with the technology, but with the whole mentality. And so far as patients are concerned, I remember when the guidance changed for the frequency of mammography to start at 50 instead of 40. And there was outrage And women wanted their mammograms. And I think part of the problem is this fear that cancer is still seen as a death threat, that there isn't this nuance. And I think you had mentioned the change in the language. Are we even talking about cancer anymore? And so are we going to redefine things to make it easier for people to relax and step back and look at evidence?
Well, Leo, I would like to tell you that, you know, people said that no woman, that's one of the things that people said, no one would participate in a trial and accept less than annual mammograms. All over the country, wherever we have this, well over 75% of women who are choosing personalized. So if you educate people, they get it. But you're right, the oncologists, you know, if your work is treating people with metastatic disease, your mentality is, oh my gosh, everyone I see dies of breast cancer or dies of whatever cancer. But that's not the universe. That's a small fraction. And so people have to understand that, you know, over-treating people who aren't going to die of their disease does not help save the person who is going to die of their disease.
Just one question for you, Laura. Are you getting a selection bias of women who choose to get involved to do the personal approach?
So 65, somewhere between 60 and 70% of women are agreeing to be randomized. And the people who are choosing, that's all we know so far. So we're really trying to, but we're trying to expand into markets around the country and to underserved populations. So we'll see. You know, that I've tried to design a trial that everyone can join so we can at least see.
Right. It's just the fact that they're joining. They're already pre-selected for that is what I'm saying.
It could be, but that's why by doing it 100,000, you know, and it we... In the randomized group is the one that's going to look at it safe, but we can actually look at the whole population to look at numbers of biopsies and numbers of things. But I think it's these kinds of trials, you know, I could be wrong, but we'll see. The data will out. Will we reduce the number of biopsies? Can we show that it's as safe and you're not going to have this over, you know, this big rush of stage 2B cancers or higher? You know, the thing to do is not to just do it, but to actually generate the data and see if that's true. I will find out.
So I will make a two-sentence complimentary comment to what Laura said. So just as mammography costs $10 billion a year, then cancer treatment costs $100 billion a year. So there's a huge discrepancy. And as Ken and others have pointed out, the cost of these tests are going to come down. And number two, everyone in this business, I've talked to Grail, everyone is worried about overdiagnosis, not having the same problems as mammography.
Do we leave it there? I think we'll break for lunch. Thank my panel. It's been a journey from metastases all the way to the healthy population and everywhere in between. So thank you and enjoy lunch.